If you know this, please join me.
Da 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 da.
It's Erev Shabbos. It's Sabbath Eve. It's Friday. The Talmud describes how there'd be hustle and bustle in the marketplace as people went to the marketplace to find foods for the Sabbath, for the Shabbat. Rabbis toing and froing, imagine that, right? Imagine the rabbis in the marketplace looking for the finest fish, for the finest delights for the Sabbath dinner, for the Sabbath Eve, Friday night, Shabbat meal. And Shabbat has an arc to it, actually. Shabbat begins on Erev Shabbat. That's also part of Shabbat. That's part of the experience. Says the verse in Genesis, Sheshet yamim ta'avod v'asita kom lachtecha. 6 days, work. Do kol melachtecha. In Hebrew, kol means all. All the work. Impossible. Impossible. Who could do all their work? Do the work and be done with the work. Kol melachtecha. Erev Shabbat is a time to recognize there is work and labor in the world where we bring a bias to action. Great phrase, that. Where we bring a bias... I was joking. I should. We bring a bias to action. What does that mean, bringing a bias to action? It's jargonese. It's one of those phrases. Being results orientated. Yes, of course. Being results or goal orientated is important to reach a goal. But we know in the Jubilee cycle, we've learned with Felicia, with Dax, with Paul, with the global musicians, that it's cyclical. That whether it's the work of surfacing stories and bringing them to the fore and allowing for the music to touch the hearts and souls of others, there is remusicking there. There's that word, remusicking. The fretwork of the musicians, the soulful singing of those musicians, brings a new timber to those stories, an overlay. The geological strata is nonlinear, it's accretive. Getting to the bedrock, getting to the core, takes digging. It takes a bet midrash. It's okay. It's a bet midrash that we need. It's a space for digging through to the magma, that hot lava, that molten rock. And what is that? What is that? It is yearning. That is the magma. It is yearning. And Erev Shabbat, the Sabbath Eve, is a time to get in touch with yearning. Yearning for a different order, a different way of being, while also being in the midst of. So join me, friends, on Erev Shabbat. You know, yesterday I mentioned about Rolf and I meeting, and I had just been struck on Thursday, a week before I came, and I was new to Holden and I had no idea what was going on. And Jeff and Emily, who I believe Jeff is a long-time faculty member and Emily of Holden, and they were in the chalet next to ours, and Thursday night there was music. There was singing. There were good times happening. And I'm quite drawn to those good times. But it takes an invitation. Jeff came over, introduced himself, said, "Hi, I'm Jeff. Would you like to come over?" And that made all the difference. All the difference. It was dark, didn't have to. He'd probably heard us unpacking our stuff. And he came over. That's an invitation. It's not just a calling from across the courtyard and saying, "Hi over there." He could have done that as well. But here I want to honor what happened on that Thursday night a week ago, just before Erev Shabbat. When Jeff came over, physically came over, and brought us together. This was the mystics' practice in the fields outside Safat. It's not enough to greet Shabbat. "Hey over there, Shabbat. I'm standing here in my synagogue and I'm praying. It's Shabbat." No. Out you go to the fields. It's reciprocal. Shabbat comes to greet us, but we, there's a movement there to greet Shabbat. It's the nigun of Shabbat. Join me. So I want to bring into our Bet Midrash the voice of Wayne Muller, Jesuit priest. His book Sabbath, a book that broke open my heart to Sabbath practice, and it didn't come from within the Jewish tradition. True story. I received this book in New York by a friend and mentor of mine, who's a rabbi of a community there. He said, "Take this." I regret my response. I won't share my response. That was the universe. I've taken this book wherever I go. Teaching. I dip into it. There are a few books that I take with me wherever I go. I'm like that. I like to take books with me. And I reread them. This is a relatively new copy. It's part of an ongoing study that we have in Seattle called Reset and Refresh. It's for interfaith or mixed heritage couples. Couples who are coming to Jewish life and practice from a variety of different perspectives, different cultures. Both partners in that relationship, committed relationship, want to be darash, want to dig in, doresh, want to dig into Jewish life together. What can it offer? And this is what I share with them. Sabbath dissolves the artificial urgency of our days because it liberates us from the need to be finished. That's what it liberates us from. Not that we are finished, from the need to be finished. Experience it as a need to close things up, to wrap things up, to have the chocolate box with a red ribbon, or forget the chocolate box with the red ribbon. Just the final email, please. There is no final email. Spoiler alert. The old wise Sabbath says, stop now. Stop. 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 As the sun touches the horizon, take the hand off the plow. Put down the phone. Let the pen rest on the paper. Turn off the computer. This is written in 1996. That doesn't help. Floating around. Leave the mop in the bucket and the car in the drive. There is no room for negotiation. No time to be seduced by the urgency of our responsibilities. We stop because there are forces larger. Forces larger than us. and they take care of the universe. And while our efforts are important, necessary, and useful, they are not, nor are we, indispensable. The galaxy will somehow manage without us for this hour, this day. And so we are invited, nay, commanded, as a word, to relax and enjoy a relative unimportance, a humble place at the table in a very large world. The deep wisdom embedded in creation will take care of things for a while. And then he says, when we breathe, we do not stop inhaling because we've taken in all the oxygen we'll ever need, but because we have all the oxygen we need for this breath. So let's take a breath, friends. So what is the secret? The Yesod Gadol in Hebrew, the great secret of Shabbat, that's embedded in the cycle that here at Holden we've been invited to release, renew, and return. In that order, release, renew, and return. Not in any other order. Could it be in any other order? What if we were to juggle this order? Could we return, renew, and release? Could we renew, release, and return? I'd like to think that these are malleable, like a juggling act, like a clown. A clown is telling us, just don't take yourself so seriously for a while. Just let it be and stop. Which one of these phrases is calling for you? Could be all three. Could be one of them. Sheshet yimim ta'avod, 6 days shall you labor, va'asisa kol melachtecha, and do all your work, v'yom ha'shvi'i Shabbat la'Hashem Elokecha. The seventh day is Shabbat, it's rest. Find the space within to access mystery. Lo ta'ase kol melacha, don't do any work. Work. Work that calls you to think in goals, in strategies, in ends. Being present, just being. Wayne Muller then writes, you can find a Shabbat moment. 25 hours seems like an awfully long time to sit in this juicy, lovely space, but come on, really? 25 hours? So right at the beginning of this teaching, I was asked a question about a practice, a Shabbat practice. Them rules for being. The word rules, we have an interesting relationship with rules. People, deities, cultures, ontologies, telling us how to be, how to act, what to say, in what way. And oh my word, if we get the order wrong, we say something in the wrong order, or not the right appointed hour or time at that hallowed hour. Heaven forfend. Now it's very important that we recognize that the architecture of Shabbat in the Hebrew liturgy is built out of the space of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle in the desert. We touched on this. So in the same way as we're crafting a space here for being Doresh, for seeking, Shabbat actually has contours to it. It has a service which invites us into the space of Shabbat. It has a meal in which we light candles and offer bread and break bread with each other and offer words of Torah and sing songs. It is that. And then in the morning, Some gather in community in prayer, others don't. Others go out with their family for a walk. Some just do slother yoga and lay in bed for a while. I like that. Wayne has some wonderful practices that he's collected, and slother yoga is just one of them. He's collected them from friends across the world, and he's collated them here. They're well worth digging into, and I commend them. I mentioned Heschel, Abraham Joshua Heschel, who Paul mentioned to me that phrase, "I felt like my feet were praying," when he was walking with Martin Luther King in the summer march. I don't know if Jeff will ever know, I don't have his email, but I'd like to find it, that I felt that it was a prayer to be invited into that space. It took someone to invite me in for me to feel comfortable. Join me. Da 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 da. Thank you. And so we draw the threads from the tapestry into this final hour together, this teaching about Shabbat. And what I'd like to do is to attend to several threads from behind that tapestry and identify them. Maybe it's the red, the yellow, and the blue thread. Maybe it's other colors of threads that are connecting you with some of the aspects of the teachings over the last days. I'd like us to find a way to wrap them together, to braid them like the challah. And this is why the challah is braided bread. It mirrors the coming together of the two candles at the beginning of Shabbat. One that commemorates Shamor et Yom HaShabbat, observe this day of Shabbat, Exodus Shabbat. And there's another one, Lekadesh et HaShabbat, honor, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, recall, remember the day of Shabbat, Deuteronomy. Two voices. One is about observing. We've been observing, we've been noticing, we've been describing. We've also been digging into memory. We've been doing memory work, storytelling, surfacing stories. These are two threads, or two braids. They are the two candles. The one candle representing, observing, noticing in the world, and the other candle representing digging into, surfacing memories, and hopefully memories that are nourishing. In fact, importantly, memories that are nourishing, memories that are uplifting, recalling family connections, recalling friendship circles, recalling our travels, recalling our days in the week to each other, the parts of them that brought us in touch with the best version of ourselves. And there's a phrase that I've heard in many camps. I do a lot of youth work. And I hear this phrase, best version of ourselves, and I wonder, what does that even mean, to be the best version of myself? It often comes along with having a personality upgrade. It's like people say self-improvement is self-torture, you know, all these things, right? I'm not one for glib phrases or catch-alls. Sometimes they help, Sometimes they get in the way. And there's one phrase or one word that I think, it was shared with me this week, a word that I wanted to use, the word was morals, that could be a speed bump for us. I'd like to just name it before we begin to talk about how Shabbat gets us in touch with living a moral life. Shabbat that is the bedrock that opens so that the magma, the yearning, can arise through the crust and surface. Not in a volcanic way, not in that way, but in a way that allows for what is potent, visceral, what is yearning. That nigun, that wordless melody that we just sang over and over again. Da-da, da-da-da-da-da, join me. Da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, anyone wants to harmonize, they can do it. Da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. So that's a thread, that's the nigun. So Shabbat has a nigun. Shabbat has its threads that are the song lines, that are the threads. How can we find our thread? How in that moment when we are behind the tapestry, when we get to look behind the days of the week, when we get to look behind the veneer, maybe when we get to be a little bit real with each other, when we get to say things from the heart, to our families, to ourselves, what emerges? Rabbi Isaiah Horitz, one of the Hasidic masters, is known as the Shnei Luchot HaBrit. Many of these masters had were given names after the books that they wrote. And he says, the verse tells us, Lo tevaru esh b'chol moshvotechem b'yom HaShabbat. You should not light a fire in all your dwelling places on the day of Shabbos. That's one of the commandments on Shabbat. Practices, don't light a fire. Don't gather things so that you are lighting a fire. This is one of the melachot, one of the works, activities in the Mishkan. He says, no. Don't get angry on Shabbat. Don't light a fire. Try to get in touch with calmness, with repose. Don't get angry on Shabbat. Or if you get there, try to listen to it. I was sitting in Felicia's class yesterday, and Felicia mentioned how rage sometimes wells up, and quite abundantly so, and quite importantly so, in protest. These are feelings which we honor and dignify. Doesn't mean that we push them down. It's part of that yearning, that magma. We feel it. We feel truly and deeply a rage on Shabbat. It's okay. Lutuvaru esh b'chol moshvotechem. But let that not be a conflagration which lights a destructive fire. But there are warming fires. Translate that into a yearning fire. Take that energy that you're feeling on the day of Shabbat, which is real, and take it into the nigun. Da 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 da, put a bit of force behind it. Da 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 da. Okay, so Shabbos is a time for getting in touch with living a moral life. So we're not talking about rules today. We're talking about what Parker Palmer calls breaking open the heart to receive. That's what we're talking about. Breaking open the heart. And so today is a conversation between two people. One who's had a huge impact on my life from when I was in my late teens until very recently, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. I love Hashalom, peace be upon him. And Parker J. Palmer, whose works I've been reading for some years, but who I met relatively recently at a retreat, at a conference, just before COVID. And I think that this time that we're living in, where it's important to call it into this space, it is not post-pandemic, I will not use that phraseology, but it is a unique time in our lifetime about a way of restructuring, reordering, recalibrating the ways in which we speak, engage one with the other. Whether we've needed to adjust from going from three-dimensional space to two-dimensional space. And there is so much written out there. I have borrowed deeply from someone called Priya Parker, who some may have heard of in this room, who writes in The Art of Gathering about how we can gather online in ways that are generative. And so there are people who have been thinking deeply for the last 2.5 years about gathering, convening. I'm sure Holden is one of these places. We're not talking about that either. We're not talking about the technology of it. We're talking about the principle of what it means to be in relationship on Shabbat, to be in a moral relationship. So yesterday I brought to the fore two other figures whom I never met, Arabella Yarrington, Warsham Yarrington, Huntington, and Sarah Berman. And those two people never met, and I imagined what it would be like for those two women to meet in real time at the early stage of their life and later in their life. That's a thread right there. That's the relational moment. But it's imagining. And that is what we're doing when we play Ba. In the same way, we're taking a thread and we are developing a relationship with one another. That is what we're doing when we're in practice of Shabbat. We are opening a space to be in relationship with each other. When I walk into a museum and I compare two, or when the curator, in this case, compares two works of art, they are being put in relation to one another. I didn't yesterday, but I would like to read what that little white tag says next to the exhibit. And it says this. This was the curator's comment. Discreet and minimalist, a closet that once belonged to a woman named Sarah Berman, 1920 to 2004, in a small Greenwich Village apartment, is on view for all to examine. A white wall opens up to reveal the closet, the contents of which include stacks of precisely folded clothing in various sizes and gradations of cream and ecru, neat piles of books, a wooden box of recipes, three black watches, a glass jar of grey buttons, a precious box. Overwhelmingly white with dashes of colour, a yellow floor, a red ball of yarn that hangs from the light. The space invites the gaze of onlookers who stop to pore over the strange, intricate precision and stay for its calming effect. It's probably not a surprise to anyone by now, but what caught me in that exhibit, what choked me in myself, what had me tear up, was the red ball of yarn hanging there. I didn't even know why. I had no idea why. For a few minutes, I just had no idea what on earth was going on. I wasn't expecting to be tearing up. And that childhood memory that I shared right there at the beginning, finding the red thread, it came to me from a memory. Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. Memory comes up, wells up from the deep, from the Tehom, from that abyss. From that great abyss of memories, some of which go deep into our unconscious, or are in our unconscious, and which the great clearing of Shabbat allows for them to surface. That is one of the threads. So there it is, an exhibition, where we have an exhibit that is completely unconnected to the memory I had of hiding behind that tapestry and seeing the red thread. And yet there it was, in that moment. And what on earth has Ruth got to do with that exhibition even? Just so happens that as I came out of that exhibition, I saw the sculpture of Ruth, and I stood there with it. And in my mind, I made a connection. I made a connection between Ruth, the story of Ruth, which is such an important story in Jewish life about clearing, of making space for reconstructing relationship, for returning to society from Shabbat, refreshed and rejuvenated, hopefully, to be adjusted, to be calibrated for maybe better relationships, better communication. And this is what I imagine Parker Palmer and Rabbi Sacks talking about the Sabbath. coming from two different faith traditions, one Quaker and the other Orthodox Jewish. And I would like to invite us into a conversation between them, imagined as it were. So let's sing. If not, please share. And the way they've been printed a little bit awry, so just need to flip. Rabbi Sacks in his book, Morality, and as you can see, so this is actually his penultimate book before he passed. He wrote one more collection of essays, which was the essays on the books of the Torah, of the five books of Moses, which he was going to complete, but he never got to the final one, the Zot HaBracha, and this is the blessing. So the final blessing that Moses gives to the children of Israel before his passing, it isn't there in that book. Everything else, all the other portions of the week are there, but the Zot HaBracha was never. The Bracha, the Brecha, the wellspring. I don't think that Rabbi Sacks thought about the book as being a source of blessing so much as a book of teaching. But I wonder about Rabbi Sacks having that gap as a source of blessing so that we could actually include our own teachings, appending them to his teachings. And I hope that maybe the book of morality that he wrote might have been Vezot HaBracha. That may have been that chapter. Again, just my imagination working, which is to say, for me, this was Vezot HaBracha. This was his charge. This was his credo, I believe, to the Jewish people, to the world. Morality. It's a heavy, heavy word. And in it, he says the following. The human condition is overwhelmingly about relationships, about faithfulness, staying true, loyal, and committed to one another. Despite all the tensions, setbacks, misunderstandings, backslidings, or the multiple ways in which we fall short. It is about consecrating the bonds between us. It is about transcending our solitude. The emphasis on I and the loss of we leaves us isolated and vulnerable. It is not good to be alone. Those are the Hebrew words, lo tov heyot adam levado, from Genesis. It is not good for the human to be alone in the world. Solitude and loneliness. We've touched on this. Reina Maria Rilke writes about two solitudes meeting one another. And in fact, Parker Palmer talks about two solitudes as being a communion between two people, two islands, as it were, of feelings, of thoughts, of mystery, meeting and connecting with each other. I mentioned the broken heart, and Parker Palmer, in conversation with this idea of a broken heart, has this to say. There are at least two ways to understand what it means to have our hearts broken. One is to imagine the heart broken into shards and scattered about, a feeling most of us know and a fate we would like to avoid. The other is to imagine the heart broken open into a new capacity, a process that is not without pain, but one that many of us would welcome. As I stand in the tragic gap between reality and possibility, the small tight fist of a thing called my heart can break open into greater capacity to hold more of my own and the world's suffering and joy, despair and hope. And that's where we were, friends, for 20 minutes, singing together, just the other day, leaning into a practice of wordless melody, Again and again, we sang that, building, yearning, our voices in unison. This was for the Hasidim. This was for the mystic masters of the Jewish tradition. This was the both and model of joy and sorrow. This is why what he says next means so much to me. There is an old Hasidic tale that tells us how such things happen. The pupil comes to the Rebbe, that is the master, and asks, why does the Torah tell us to place these words upon our heart? Why does it not tell us to place these holy words within our hearts? The Rebbe answers, it is because, as we are, our hearts are closed, and we cannot place the holy words in our hearts. So we place them on top of our hearts, and there they stay until one day the heart breaks and the words fall in.
Five times we're going to do this.
Made to live alone. To be sure, some have sung the praise of solitude, but for the most part, our hopes, our happiness, our identity are shaped by face-to-face interactions with others, which is where the moral sense is born, where we learn what it is to be loved, and where it is to love and be loved, trust and be trusted, where we internalize those rules of conduct that allow us to engage in collaborative enterprise, where we gradually develop our instincts of empathy, sympathy, compassion, pity, kindness, generosity, hospitality, charity, and the rest. I wonder about that. I wonder about the choice of words here. Rabbi Sacks isn't going to a thesaurus and just saying, okay, how many words can I just shove there? I haven't done it, but I would like to sit with someone, a chavruta, and dig into the etymology of these words. I understand them from both English and Hebrew, maybe other faith traditions. Dig into what it means to say the word empathy and sympathy and compassion and so forth. They're not the same. They're not the same word. They have certain valences. And that is the nigun also. I was with Rolf, we were having a conversation, and I hope it's okay if I share this. And I started, "Di-da-da," Rolf said, you're changing things up for me. The last time it was la-la-lai. Yeah? What's the difference between di-da-dum and la-la-lai? It's the world. It's the world of difference. That is the wordless nigun. It is a play with sounds, right? But the sounds don't have an inherent meaning other than the sound that it's communicating from within. The resonance is the breath. Di-da-da could sound different from la-la-la, maybe. And so I'm a wordsmith, I like words, and so I'd like to be in conversation about these words. Rabbi Sacks says the following, and here's where the speed bump could be. And I'd like to invite us into conversation with just to the person next to us on this. Where do you think the moral life emerges? If there is such a thing as a moral life for you, if there is a moral life, there is a life of morality. I'm going to use that word. I'm just going to put that word out there. Morality. Okay? What does that word mean to you? And for you, where does it emerge? What are the experiences which communicate to you living morally? Okay? So, the question is, from where does a moral life emerge for you? Again, we're not here to fix, we're not We're here to ask questions. There is the word moral. It does have a root in the Latin. We're not going there. We're not looking at that word from that perspective. We're just asking the question, if there is to be a moral life for you, where does it emerge? Any clarifying questions on that? Okay, we're going to take 5 minutes for that. Just turn to your partner. Please introduce yourselves. To be fully human, we need direct encounters in one another's presence. Open to their otherness, alert to their hopes and fears, engaged in a minuet of conversation. The delicate back and forth of speaking and listening. That is how relationships are made. That is how we become moral beings. Scanning the room for any reflections on the experience of being in that moment just now. Yes.
Sometimes words are, we think we understand what somebody else is saying, but sometimes we have to approach it just to let go of ours, to engage the word as the context emerges, that sometimes the word is first and then the context of where that's coming from within that person only emerges in kind of a sideways. It doesn't come directly like the word itself, but it comes sideways. The emotion, the passion, the engagement that emerges.
Third things are used, says Parker Palmer, in order to indirectly get to the heart of the matter. Why is it that third things, like texts, like poetry, like music, is evocative and allows us, as that allows what he calls the shy soul, to reveal itself? Sometimes conversations themselves can be those third things. You have a conversation, and then a few hours later, a few days later, a few months, or years later, that conversation becomes its own third thing. Mark.
My conversation partner and I came on what we thought was an interesting question. We were talking about the connection of morality has to be with others. Yeah, it's lived in community. We wonder, if you were stranded on a desert island by yourself, could you live a moral life?
Well, we brought up that you need to be moral also, or not need to, but morality also comes about with the earth and living things on the earth.
Yeah.
So even on a deserted island, there's a little crab.
Thank you. Parker Palmer's work, A Hidden Wholeness. A Hidden Wholeness is his part memoir, part a how-to, creating a circle of trust in an intentional community. What is it to build circles of trust? And Parker Palmer has founded the Center for Courage and Renewal, which I believe began on Bainbridge Island, but has reached the world, really. And now online, if you go online to the Center of Courage and Renewal, you can be trained in, you can become a facilitator of this work. I am not a facilitator of this work. I would like to take training to be in that place. And it's a three-year program. You meet, you know, once every 2 months, I believe. It was disrupted by COVID, but they're about to start a new cohort. And in a circle of trust, you meet with the same group of people every time. And you meet, and there is an individual who is given space to just be with themselves, to allow for that heart to break open in a space. And the circle holds it. And for Parker, I believe, this is how he shared it with me, a circle of trust is born out of its constituent parts. Even the facilitator is a part of that circle of trust, is not a part of that circle of trust. And the circle of trust, like Shabbat, is there ever present. It is a circle that is a container for your life. It's a third thing, so that when you leave it, you can borrow from the experience of being with others in that kind of a community, even though that kind of way of being with one another is simply just not the way we are in the everyday. I don't know about you, but my experience of being at Holden, it's the first time I've been here. And I mentioned it last night, it truly is a different way of being on its surface. And I also want to name all the ways in which Holden comes to be that require bringing a bias of action, being goal-orientated, being task-orientated. And what happens when those two prerogatives bump up against each other? When I want to be just in that space for the moment, but all the taskiness is following me into that space. What happens when I want to be calm and in repose, but I'm feeling really frustrated right now, especially with you? But I'm just gonna have my face on. I'm not gonna share that with you. And what does a feedback loop look like when I'm in a space where other people are clearly floating upon the gravel and I'm in a pattern of putting out fires and batting balls across the net all day? How can I access some of that repose that I'm clearly seeing is happening all around me? People are reading books. I want to acknowledge that there is a staff experience, and there are others of us here at Holden having a different experience. And I believe that actually the experience of being at Holden for me is a container that contains all of that. These are the tectonic plates of noticing. These are the different stories that go into making a place. And it's not vanilla, although it's darn good ice cream. It's not vanilla, sorry. It's not vanilla. It's real. Now the question is, how can we break open that crust so that when we have an exchange with someone else, it's a real exchange? If the question is really meant, asked. If the encounter, the experience is genuinely felt, I feel you're genuinely asking. It's not just a hi, how are you? I'm genuinely asking you. Can we do that? Here? Can we do that anywhere? Anywhere can we do that? Sarah Berman's closet appeared on the streets of New York City in direct contrast to what was going on those streets. The frenetic activity, I lived in New York for a number of years, the frenetic activity of pounding the streets of New York in search of whatever it was that I'm in search of. That kind of exchange, which is often a very transactional exchange. I'm suddenly in conversation, I'm invited to pause I'm not asked to pay anything. I'm not asked to even make a donation. I just am arrested by, there's something there that shouldn't be there. There's a closet on the street with someone's clothes in it. What's going on? So that is the moment of repose, okay? That is Shabbat. Stop. Stop. There's something there that's saying stop. Notice. That's a practice. And it's not so much there are rules of engagement or rules of conduct. There are what Parker Palmer calls circle of trust touchstones. And I've just left a few of these out for people to take. We're not going to go into them in great depth today, but just in case you're interested, these are the touchstones, he calls them. Not rules, not community norms, but touchstones. To walk softly in the world in this way, to co-create a community through certain modes of practice. These are his, what he calls Shabbat modes, Sabbath modes. And so, I think that one of the threads that is apparent to me is the thread of relationships. The thread of thinking about being in relationship with the people we're in all the week and on the weekend and Shabbat. If we could choose Shabbat as a prism through which to look at our relationships differently, choose one aspect of those relationships that we might go into deeper, think about. That is, for me, one of the threads that I hope you walk out of Holden taking. What is an adjustment? Not what is a self-improvement. What is an adjustment that allows for a different way of listening, that minuet of conversation? Now, the other day, coming back, we spoke about a community, a society, which needed to hear the call to release every 7 years, when the king or the monarch would gather the people at the sacred space, there was a sacred space, and would read themselves from the scroll that said, "We do not keep slaves here. We do not keep slaves here." Someone asked me, "So what happened? So the next year, after this release, we just go back to keeping slaves in the 49th year, right? Great, all slaves go free. But then the next Jubilee cycle, what happens? Just slavery again?" So the commentators say this was a practice to hold the story of the Exodus from Egypt in the community, such that if I'm 7 years old, if I'm 14 years old, if I'm 21 years old, I'm hearing this story again and again, and it is calling me to a different way of being in the world. It is calling me to say, no, this is not my way, this is not our way. It is an invitation to be a different way. That is not to say that there wasn't slavery, but it stops the slavery becoming systemic and endemic. Because if you're confronted by the king, by the apex society, of society saying, this is something that I have been confronted with, then the hope is, the aspiration is, that all of society will recognize that this is not something, this is not a bedrock that we build our community on. That is the hope of the text. That is the cycle. That is a Jubilee cycle. That is the listening to. Now let me share a personal story. It's Thanksgiving several years ago, and I am going to Whidbey Island. For the first time, actually. I'm quite excited. I'm told that Whidbey Island is a magical place. And we get off that boat, that ferry, the pulse of the traffic just stops, if but for a while, and you can drive off into whichever Airbnb you've booked, and have a wonderful, wonderful time. That's what I was looking for. It's only one small problem. It was raining. It was getting dark. My phone wasn't working. And I was pretty darn sure that I'd lost the way and I was in the wrong place. I'd been given very, very clear instructions. But still, I thought to myself, I'm going to have to back out of here and do this again. Because I arrived at a house. Lots of cars were there on the drive. Around 6 or 7 o'clock, maybe. 6 o'clock. And it didn't look like the Airbnb online. It was a house. And people were in it. So I timidly walk up the stairs and I knock on the door. And someone comes out and welcomes me with the following. Hi, are you Sam? Yes. Are you hungry? I was actually really hungry, but I'm British, so you don't ever say, yes, I'm really hungry. Ever, ever. I don't know, I think it was the bear hug that did it. It was also the bibs. And this was Jim. Jim and I met on Thanksgiving, and Jim, you and I have had a relationship and a conversation going since, and I'd like to invite you into a conversation with me, because that evening something magical happened. I was invited into a Shabbat moment. I was invited around your table. I was invited to partake of your meal, and in that invitation there was the beginning of a friendship and a relationship. And so I hope, friends, if we can, to goldfish bowl style, I'd like to have a conversation, the two of us, about Parker Palmer and Rabbi Sacks. And I'll give Jim, if you will, introduce yourself and a bit of your tradition. And then we're going to have a 10-minute conversation about some of the material that we have been reading in these books. And I invite you to either listen in or to write down what's coming up for you as we have this conversation.
Hi, I'm Jim Paul, and I have an Airbnb on Whidbey Island. And I am a recovering Episcopalian who's been a Quaker for the last 30-some years. My wife and I had the opportunity to spend a few years on the East Coast and tumbled into a small Quaker meeting house shortly after we were married, and we were trying to find a faith community that would hold us. And after 10 minutes sitting in a quiet worship circle amongst other Quakers, we said we're home. So, and Samuel and I have now had the opportunity to be with each other several times, and it's a delight. So I have a Quaker background, and I'm coming. The thought of assuming kind of the essence of Parker Palmer is a delight and scares the heck out of me.
But let's start with a phrase, a hidden wholeness. What does that phrase mean for you, a hidden wholeness?
Yeah. The hidden wholeness for me is the idea that within me, in my home, in my center, there is an absolute completeness and wholeness if I choose to show it, if I choose to come to it. And in the culture that I live in, that we live in, there's often a temptation to hide that wholeness. Or portions of it. How about for you?
I was brought up with this idea that wholeness is directly related to the word shalom, peace, and shlemut, which is, we talk about completion or integrity, but these are all words for me. For me, it is what Parker Palmer says, the shy soul revealing itself. It is my desire to speak, engage, and talk with you, because I know, somehow, viscerally, that if I say something, if I stumble, if I say something awkward,
if I make a bar, you'll hold me. You'll be okay. That for me is the hidden wholeness. That there's a trust in this in-between space between us, such that I can, if I pause, you can catch me. That for me is what it means by hidden wholeness. A sense of deep, deep abiding trust in this, whatever it is. And I'm curious about this idea of morality, because we've been talking about this, and what, you know, Warren Sachs writes about morality, about being about the, you know, the conversation between human beings, or between a human being and a crab. maybe, I don't know, but between two solitudes, is morality a speed bump for you, that word? Is that it?
The way that I grew up, morality is a bit of a speed bump because I associate morality with a whole bunch of rules or shoulds. And so I actually take the word morality and sort of transform it into integrity, which is an integration, a trust, a way of being, an opportunity or an invitation to vulnerability, to openness, to accompaniment with myself and with others. And in fact, I would go as far as to say as the circles of trust that I've been associated with, and I'm not talking about just as Parker Palmer, but as in my Quaker circles. When I think of being with you, for example, and let's just say you pop in and you are in this circle of trust or investigating the circle of trust, we have an opportunity to share our solitude, to accompany each other without advising or counseling each other.
Or fixing
each other. Heaven forbid my wife taught me that one. Please, dear, just listen to me.
So why do we? I mean, that's me when Rabbi Sachs, I'm reading Rabbi Sachs, and he doesn't use the word language of fixing, but he does use the language of listening, as Parker does. And I'm interested in that word, listening. Why is it that listening is so hard? Why is it that there are so many ways in which we can miscommunicate with each other? And what does it look like for you to communicate deeply and fully in the world? What does that look like for you as a Quaker or as a human being?
It means to take a moment before responding. It asks me to stop, Shabbat stop, not run the foot race of getting to what I want to say, and instead taking the breath, allowing you to hear yourself as well as me to hear you.
Okay, I'm hearing a lot of but can we just have a concrete example, please, of what that looks like?
About your son.
Which one?
Tell me about Alicia.
Alicia is in Israel, and he has emigrated there, and his mother and I are seen him grow so much over the last 5 years that he's been there. He's taken steps to integrate into Israeli life and culture with sensitivity. He seeks out, it seems to me, to seek out spaces to talk with people. And he's one of those deep and meaningful young adults that, you know, they love the long conversations. So he's one of those. He loves to drop into a long conversation with one person rather than be, you know, out with many people. And sometimes that's been really difficult for him because he's been shy. And when he's gone into a place, and here I want to be careful of sharing what I think he would be okay with me sharing, it's been hard for him to walk into a crowded room with people he doesn't know. And just seeing him go to a different country, not knowing the language in that way, conversationally, and finding access points in a way that are generative for him is something I'm very proud of. He's also my firstborn. So we've had a tempestuous relationship. And so we're at a really good place right now.
What three words would describe him? What three words come out of your heart when you think of Elisha?
Gentle comes. It's a hard question to. Gentle definitely comes, and it's really hard. Very focused on a goal. He's very, the word I was going to use was stubborn. That's the word that came to me, stubborn. And then transigent. But yes, tenacious will work. Tenacious is hard. Tenacious does feel right. So does stubborn. Thank you. Can I return the question? Yeah. What three words would you use to describe your daughter? Beautiful.
Guarded. Brave.
Lunch for a meal, the idea is to walk them from the house actually, to accompany them out into the world after that experience. Four steps. And then if you want to walk more, of course, you can do so. And then some walk to the end of the road, and stop there and take leave. This idea of drawing the experience out from whatever was created around the table into the world is accompaniment. That is absolutely a Shabbat practice. Not just to say goodbye at the doorstep or the threshold, but to walk over the threshold and into the world together.
So when you walked up, I'm going back to our first meeting, when you walked up those stairs and it was raining on you, and greeted you, and then we had 3 hours together, then you turned to me and said, "Can we do this again tomorrow night?" What an incredibly lovely accompaniment that was. I know I'm going out of my rule here a little bit, but if I was to bring my practice experience from circles of trust into our discussion here, there's nothing more important, there's nothing more sacred to me than the idea that we are not repairing or fixing, we are allowing the experience and the words and the time after time after time again to rest upon the heart until it's ready to open up. And that person then because of the way they've been accompanied, finds that they can return at their own speed, in their own way.
So let's accompany each other. The final closing of our time together, this arc of learning, this conversation that we've been having, these years that have led us to this moment, we would not have been here were it not for this relationship.
No.
Wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
To be in this moment right now, to quieten, perhaps if someone could just close the door back over there, I'd be grateful. And if we could switch off the lights. Okay.
We've learned much. We've been in conversation. We've tried to put a pause, a Sabbath, on the urge to analyze and interpret and get to that place and just notice. So in these final 7 minutes together, let's return to that wordless melody on Erev Shabbat, on Sabbath Eve, the Jewish Sabbath Eve, that is, which might bring us into that place of noticing whatever threads from across the week of learning, whichever threads you were following, whichever connected. The question was asked, and it is something that I want to just check in with. You know, so in the source sheets you've given out, notice that you didn't do all the sources, and sometimes you did few of the sources. What's with that? So these are third things. It's not a breathless run through to the end. It's not that I have to scaffold it so that in the moment I select and engage with certain voices, but offer the opportunity to do so. And therefore, for those that would like to have their name on the packet, I will be sending through Holden all of the packets out to you, or with Holden, so that you can have them. And I'm happy to do it myself as well, just to take that task on myself so I can also do it. So if at the close you want to write your name, please do. And if not, my email address is on the front of the packet. You can take a photograph of it from any one of the packets and then be in touch with me and I'll send it to you. unreasonable request. Please stay in the room, if you can, until the final syllable, the ligon.
Yeah.
good Shabbos. Shabbat Shalom.
That's good.